I want to tell you my secret now. I see dead people.
Silent Green is people!
No, I am the Father.
Rosebud. What's in the box?
You maniac! You blew it up! Damn you all to hell!
Hello, and welcome to this episode of Slate Spoiler Specials. I'm Sam Adams, a senior editor at Slate, and this time we're spoiling The Sandman, the first season of the Netflix series based on Neil Gaiman's comic books. This is the story about the Lord of Dreams, who finds himself imprisoned by human sorcerers for almost a century, does battle with Lucifer herself, and is then threatened with the destruction of his realm by an eye-eating serial killer called the Corinthian. Spoiling alongside me is Slate's book critic, Laura Miller. Hello, Laura.
Hi, Sam.
This is a project that's been in the works for decades since these comics were originally published in the late 1980s. So I just wanted to start by sort of establishing what sort of baggage you and I are bringing to this. So, Laura, are you a fan of the comic books? What sort of expectations did you come to this series with?
I'm a fan of them and of Gaiman's novels in general. And I know that he thinks of The Sandman as being sort of his magnum opus, but for me, it feels a little on the jejune side. It's a feels like more of an early work. Although, of course, it's fabulous that he collected, you know, all of these artists together to represent his vision with him. And the work that did was amazing. I do kind of feel like some of his later work is a little on the more mature side and easier for me to, I don't know, identify with. But nevertheless, Sandman does have a special place in my heart. It was the first graphic novel that really made me love the form and took it to places that were the kind of places I wanted to go. And I think like a lot of women feel the same way about Sandman. They maybe didn't get hooked in by superhero narratives, but this more mythic storyline had a deeper appeal.
Right. Yeah. No, I came to this. I mean, I was a huge Sandman fan when most of the comics were coming out. I still have a very clear memory of the first issue that I picked up, which is part of one of the episodes in this first season, and that takes place at a convention of serial killers. I remember like picking this up off the spinner rack at my local Walden Books. All the original issues have these incredibly like elaborate, beautiful Dave McKean collages for their covers. And it was just like, what's this? And it just like blew me away. I was sort of instantly swept away by the whole thing. Early pandemic, a couple months in when it became clear that I wasn't going to be spending any money on like restaurants or travel or concerts for quite some time, I took a small portion of that money that I wasn't spending and bought one of the sort of large deluxe oversized anthologies of The Sandman, which you have, if you have $100, you're not doing anything with lying around, is a pretty nice purchase. Reread them and they still kind of strike me very much the same way. I think in some ways I may be attached to those initial reactions. They hold up extraordinarily well. So I came to this as someone who's, you know, a big fan of the comics, but also I've seen a lot of comics that I have been big fans of adapted very badly. So I was, including some by Neil Gaiman. So I was excited, but anxious, I guess I would describe my mien going into this.
So what did you think? I mean, did they get anywhere close to conveying that incredible galvanizing experience that you had when you first picked up that issue?
I mean, there are parts of it I like a lot. I mean, I was definitely, I knew, I had some sense of how I was going to react to this when I saw the first trailer, and there are images in that just in that trailer and all throughout the series that are just taken directly from the comic books. And I was just like, oh man, like this is total fanboy shit that I would normally try to be above. But in this case, it's just absolutely not. Like I just, you know, the little prison in Roderick Burgess's basement, the Dream gets locked up in, the first shot of Desire's, you know, palace. I can't resist it. You know, so I loved that stuff. One thing comics can do that I really like and is really exciting is they can do sort of crazy one-off issues where they, you know, bring in a different set of artists. This issue takes place in a world where everyone's made of cheese. Like they could just do crazy stuff for an issue and then go right back to the main storyline. And because all these, you know, Marvel and DC universes are calculated to make you feel like if you haven't watched the previous 50 hours of content, You're going to be left behind, so you have to subscribe to whatever service and constantly be watching it. They don't do those sorts of things. And Sandman was really built around that whole ethos. And it's not even just the one-offs, but like every storyline would have like a different set of artists. And because the main character is the Lord of Dreams, he lives in a lot of different worlds and they're always sort of changing shape and look. And Gaiman would change the way he wrote. And he would really just, I mean, it's an amazing springboard for like a super ambitious writer in his late 20s, for one thing, because it's like, look at all the different things I can show. I can do horror, I can do Shakespeare, I can do this, I can do that. And this, I guess because it's a TV series and you just need more of a sense of coherence, this really doesn't have that excitement to me. And I feel like the look of it is kind of bog standard BBC adaptation. So it's kind of let down by that on that respect. I'm glad that people are liking it. I sort of was a little iffy about it. What did you think, Laura?
I mean, I agree with what you say about the lack of visual panache. I mean, sometimes it looks really good, but it always looks good in kind of the same way, I think is what you're saying. You know, if you did the issue where people were all made out of cheese, then you'd get in someone who was really good at drawing cheese, but they'd just be there for a little while, and then you'd have somebody else come in later. I think there's a possibility for it to go in that direction, but I think to get it established first, it does need that continuity that you were talking about. There was this adaptation that was an audio-only adaptation, which you would think would be even more difficult because the comics are so visual. But I felt that it really worked, partly because it was liberated in some ways from the need to sort of reproduce the world visually. And as a result, the actors were more free to interpret the characters in ways that worked for a drama. I mean, because all you can have with audio is a drama, they had to make it more dramatic. I think the problem that this series confronts and sometimes solves and sometimes doesn't is that there's not a lot of traditional drama inherent in the first, you know, few issues or episodes of The Sandman. It's mostly just the sort of world building and tone establishing that you sort of need to do because you're presenting an entirely new sort of mythos. You know, these characters, the Dream and his siblings are like gods, but they're also like these allegorical personifications. They're not like any, they're not a familiar god from a different cultural tradition that you might have heard of. And so, you know, you have to ramp up sort of more slowly. You know, you have to be told what's going on. And I do think there's room for it to be wildly different in tone going forward if the series has a chance to go forward. But there is just the problem that the main character, at least at the beginning, is trapped in a glass box and refusing to speak, which makes him not very compelling. And then once he gets out, you know, he's sort of this impassive person. He obviously has feelings, and we eventually learn that he's had all these relationships, but he seems just, you know, his affect is very flat and just sort of uniformly broody and somber. And it's sort of hard to sort of figure out if he's the main character and where he's going. And that to me is like a dramatic problem that the audio adaptation was, oddly enough, more capable of sort of reworking in its own interest than the series has been. But I still really like the series a lot.
Well, we're not going to walk through every plot detail of 11 hours of content, but let's sort of deal with this in terms of arcs. There's sort of two main storylines in this first season, and then a couple of one-off episodes, which I think we'll talk about at the end. Before we get to that, let's take a quick break. And we're back. The first storyline is, as we sort of mentioned, Morpheus, the King of Dreams, is it's in the 19-teens we start off, and Morpheus, the King of Dreams, is imprisoned by this sort of occultist named Roderick Burgess, who is trying to capture Death. His son was killed in World War I, and he's trying to bring him back. So he casts the spell, accidentally captures Dream, and then holds him captive for basically the better part of a century, during which time many parts of the world sort of go to hell in various ways. Eventually he does get out, but he's had the tools of his office stolen from him, which are a helmet, a pouch of dream sand and basically a magic ruby. And so there's an episode each devoted to getting those things back, which climaxes in the infamous diner episode. But before we get to that, what did you make of these first, I guess, sort of four episodes before we get to the diner, Laura?
Well, you know, I think I liked the one where he goes to hell the best because it's kind of a classic form of legend, you know, the sort of transformation battle, you know, two magical beings constantly changing their shapes in a contest, you know, a battle. So, you know, one person might be a snake, then the other person might turn into an elephant, and then they have the edge, and then the first person then turns into a mouse and scares the elephant. Those are some of the classic ones, and it's a type of legend that occurs through a lot of cultures. And I also really loved Gwendolyn Christie as Lucifer, Morningstar, the devil, just not how you typically see that character depicted. She looks kind of like an angel, though she has bat wings, and she has a sort of weird angelic manner about her. And she is a powerful being like Dream, and so contest between them is well matched. The transformational duel that he has is with a demon. But, you know, you feel like the stakes are high for him, and you know, she's an interesting antagonist as opposed to these sort of hapless human beings who he basically has to hunt down like some kind of detective. So that was probably my favorite one. There were things about the comic that I never really got. Like, I never really understood why Cain and Abel live in the dreaming and what they have to do with anything. I loved the way that the character Lucienne was reimagined and played by the actress Vivienne. I'm going to mangle this pronunciation, but Achiampong, she's fantastic. I mean, there are little things I liked in all of them, but as a whole, I think I liked the Battle in Hell one better than the other ones.
Right. I mean, you mentioned both Lucienne and Lucifer, played by Gwendolyn Christie, in this. And it's important to note, just for the whole series, I think this is, in general, an extremely faithful adaptation of the comics. I mean, down to the images, as I mentioned, but also the dialogue is often, you know, word for word from Gaiman's word balloons. But one thing they do is, you know, and the comic is looking back on it now in a way that not many people were thinking about in, like, the late 80s, is extremely white and extremely male. So they have gender flipped primarily, and race bent a little bit, but mostly just sort of gender flipped a lot of the roles. So Dream's librarian Lucienne becomes Lucienne. Lucifer becomes a woman, if to the extent that angels have gender in the first place. Desire is played by a non-binary actor.
That character was, Desire was almost kind of non-binary to begin with. Like, I just remember thinking, is that a boy or a girl or both, right, or neither? Yeah.
Few people were using that word at the time, and the comic certainly didn't. But I mean, that is, yeah, that doesn't even really count. That is almost more faithful than a change. But yeah, it's, you know, still, like, noteworthy, I guess should be the term, in terms of mainstream TV casting.
Yeah, it's perfectly cast. I mean, this is exactly what that character should be like. In addition to being just a cool casting move, it is the perfect casting move.
Yeah, no, it's really, yeah, absolutely great. So yeah, so we go through this whole series of machinations, some of which, you know, work better than others. I like the Hell episode as well, again, mostly because of Gwendolyn Christie, who just has a great sort of, you know, satanic presence in her performance. And then we get to the diner episode, which is probably worth dealing with itself. Do you want to sort of set up the premise there, Laura, a little bit?
While Dream is tracking down his lost talismans or whatever they are, his tools, there's a person named John Dee who is named after an Elizabethan magician. I don't know why, but at any rate, he's a sort of a crazy guy who got the ruby from his mother, who was the lover of the occultist who captured Dream. And its power is that it can sort of make dreams come true. Although one of the weird things about this series is that it doesn't make that much of a distinction between sleeping dreams and sort of daydreams or wishes. So it's never, you know, really clear what kind of dreams are coming true. And he's chasing this guy trying to get the ruby back. And the guy goes into this 24-hour diner, and there's a bunch of people in there, And he basically sort of strips away all their pretensions, because John Dee has this thing of like, he's one of these radical honesty type guys that people should just do and say whatever they want. And it turns into this sort of weird debacle of sex and grotesque violence. And I'm just going to come right out here and say this is the one issue of The Sandman that I hated. And I also hated the episode based on it, for more or less the same reasons. Like, I kept hoping it would be better than the comic book, but ultimately it just really didn't do it for me. I thought in the original, it was just very edgelordish, although that word didn't exist at the time. It was like, this is so dark. This is so violent. It was so sort of self-congratulatory about its darkness. And I kind of didn't really believe it. Like, I didn't really believe that all these people were seething with all of these like violent yearnings. It just seemed completely over the top. And it remains like, you know, my least favorite episode in this episodic story.
Right. I mean, I think I might have just been a teenage edgelord when I read that episode the first time, but I definitely remember liking it a lot. And, you know, I still like find it pretty powerful in the comic, mostly because it's so condensed in the comic. It, you know, there's a lot of like pretty gory, awful stuff that happens in it. People like nailing their hands to countertops and gouging out their own eyes and stuff like that. But a lot of that sort of happens either, you know, between panels or just in a single panel or something. That it's that I find really effective. You know, when you blow that up into an hour of TV, really sort of showing people doing that stuff, I think it does lose some of its power. You know, when I started the series, I was like, I don't know how this is, but I'm definitely going to watch the diner episode because I got to see how they do that. I do like David Thewlis as John Dee a lot. I think that's a great performance.
I love him. Yeah. Yeah. He's fantastic. I mean, David Thewlis is fantastic in everything. And he's particularly good at playing sort of bad guys who are sort of chaos agents. And in this, you know, he sort of reprises a type of character he's played throughout his career. I mean, definitely it is hugely enhanced, because if I remember correctly, in the comic, it's the madman is just this kind of repulsive toad-like guy, sort of like, you know, rubbing his hands together in the corner about how people are gouging their eyes out, which, like, I just do not understand how that is anybody's dream. So, I mean, that's where it's confused. Like, you might have a nightmare where you gouge your own eyes out, although I don't know how many people have ever had a nightmare like that. And you might have a fantasy about having sex with your coworker, but it's all kind of jumbled up together in this way that I found unconvincing. But he is fantastic. I mean, I actually like all of the scenes with him and Julie Richardson, who plays his mother, so much. You know, they're both so good together that it did redeem it a little bit for me. But I just hate that whole diner storyline so much.
Yeah. All right. Well, so Dream eventually gets his tools back and his powers, but there's more trouble yet to come. But before we get to this next section of the story, let's take a quick break to hear from one of our sponsors. And we're back. All right, so Morpheus, the Lord of Dreams, has successfully regained all the tools of his office, destroyed them, and gotten back more power than he's ever had in millennia. Things seem to be going pretty well for him. But unfortunately, there are two people roaming around the world who are going to pose pretty big problems for him. One is a character named the Corinthian, played by Boyd Holbrook, who is sort of a rogue nightmare who has made his way into the waking world when Dream was imprisoned, and is now basically a serial killer who rips out people's eyes and eats them with his own eyes, which are actually little mounts. And the other one is Rose Walker, who is a dream vortex, which is basically a human born with the power to destroy or the boundaries between the dream world and the waking world and thus obliterate both of them. You know, this, I think, looking back, is really where the comic kind of came into its own. Like, the initial sort of fetch quest cycle is, you know, you see what's coming, but Doll's House is really where Gaiman's imagination started to take off, and the comic was already an enormous hit at that point. Laura, what did you make of this Doll's House mini story?
I agree with you. Here we have a character who is human, and so therefore is going through a journey of self-discovery. I mean, she finds out that she has a living relative that she didn't know about. She's trying to, this is Rose Walker, she's trying to reunite with her little brother who has been in a foster home. And in the meantime, she's being pursued by the Corinthian who just wants to just sort of burn it all down and help her do it. And also by Dream, who is trying to, well, I mean, you eventually realize that the only way that he can keep the vortex from destroying everything is by killing her. And even though he is also friendly to her in a way. And along the way on this quest, they meet another runaway dream called Fiddler's Green, played by Stephen Fry. And they go to this wacky convention of serial killers, which I think is funny in a way that the diner scene was not. I definitely felt like with the idea of the serial killer convention that is like a science fiction convention, only everybody is a serial killer and is sort of indirectly talking about their work, but not being too explicit about it. The humor that I think Gaiman is really good at starts to come through and really adds a lot to the story, along with the human quest of Rose to reunite with her brother and to sort of figure out what's going on with her and these people that she meets in this boarding house that she stays in. All of that is where the whole series just gels.
Right. I mean, I wanted to see the convention episode updated a little bit to sort of modernize it a little bit because it's so, it's such a, Neil Gaiman, you know, in addition to being like a sort of comics nut, was initially kind of worked as a journalist. His first book was a quickie bio of Duran Duran, and he wrote the sort of fan's guide to Douglas Adams' Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. So he worked in kind of, you know, fan culture from numerous angles. And this issue, I think a little more sharply than the episode, are really just such a pointed and somewhat vicious attack on like convention culture. It's just all these like, you know, sort of sweaty misfits getting together, you know, talking about how good it is that they feel understood. But instead of just being kind of like creepy comic book nerds, they're actually murderers. So I think the commentary is pretty succinct. I wish, you know, this could have felt a little bit more like a con in 2022 than it does sort of one in the 1980s. But I love that aspect of it. And it's something that comes back in the Calliope episode, which we'll talk a little bit more. But yeah, you can see Gaiman both in his late 20s and now in his 60s really taking aim at aspects of sort of, you know, fan culture and writerly arrogance and stuff like that. You know, I think the show is really at its best when it's working on a bunch of different levels at once. And that's like, that's an episode where it all really comes together very well for me.
Well, I'm going to guess the more generic nature of the conference is meant to make it more relatable to more people, because not that many people have been to fan conventions, although Comic-Con is really popular. But it could be a convention of like car salesmen or something. And then they're so excited they want to bring the Corinthian in because he is like a celebrity within their little scene. And he's like the guy who sold like more Cadillacs than anybody else. You know, who else wants to bring a notorious serial killer into their own company? And they're sort of also kind of scared of him. Like the fact that it's in this kind of banal sort of, you know, Marriott type hotel is just so funny to me that I really enjoyed that whole aspect and the comical way all the different serial killers, their pride and their own little bailiwick and their desire to, what do they call themselves, collectors. So it's like the desire to keep on collecting, but then knowing that they can't while they're at this convention because it's against the rules. It's sort of like the Hitman Hotel and in John Wick, where you like, it's where all the hitmen stay, but you can't hit anybody when you're in the motel. You know, it's just a very clever, funny thing. And I appreciate that it's not as sharp about fan culture, but I do think it's meant to just, you know, speak to anyone who's ever been to a convention of any kind.
All right, so that sort of wraps up the main story of the Sandman's first season. But there's a lot of things in this that aren't the main story. We're going to talk about those a little bit after we hear from one of our sponsors. If you enjoy spoiler specials, the best way to support the show is by joining Slate Plus, Slate's membership program. You'll get no ads on any Slate podcasts, unlimited reading on the Slate website, and access to every article and advice column on Slate, never hitting the paywall. You'll also get bonus segments or episodes on shows like Slow Burn, Political Gabfest, and The Culture Gabfest. And you'll also be supporting podcasts like this one, which would not be possible without your support. Slate Plus helps keep this show going. To join today, go to slate.com/spoilerplus. Again, that's slate.com/spoilerplus. And we're back. All right, so Laura, we've discussed sort of the main storylines in this first season, but as I mentioned, you know, one of the great things about the comic is that it can sometimes shoot off in different directions for an issue or two. And the series does it in two episodes, one of which actually dropped after the main season arrived. We were told it was going to be a 10-episode season, then surprise, it was an 11-episode season. But let's kind of go through those. The first of those is The Sound of Her Wings, is the name of the comic book issue. And this introduces the first of the Endless, other than Dream, who we really get to know, which is his sister, Death. What did you think of this half an episode, I guess?
Well, this is also one of my favorite interludes in the comics. And it was one of my favorite episodes of the series, partly because Gaiman's characterization of Death is so lovely. She's so sympathetic and warm. She's a great counterpoint to his impassiveness. And also she's constantly sort of teasing him about his impassiveness. And there's this kind of concern for the human that she has that he lacks, and that she's trying to sort of, you know, give him a glimpse of. I know that in the original, the character was this sort of punkette character, which felt very fresh and inventive, and many, many people developed huge crushes on that character. And this is one of the characters that has been cast by an actor in a different race. So she's not exactly a punkette, but she's still the same basic character. And just so, you know, just so welcome in the sort of somber, dark, like I said, edgelordy narratives that we've seen, this kind of warm, sort of, I guess, feminine energy. And she's beautifully played by Kirby Howell-Baptiste. I just think she's magnificently cast. And she's just a great counterpoint to him. There's a scene where she takes him into a pub in the Middle Ages, and she's trying to get him to loosen up, and he's such a stiff. And instead of that being like something that sort of puts you off, it becomes funny, which is something I really enjoyed.
Right. I mean, looking back on it now, I mean, I certainly had a crush on, you know, the Sandman's Death, like every other, you know, everyone else at the time. But, you know, looking back on her, she is a little bit of a, you know, manic pixie dream girl type. And Kirby Howell-Baptiste, you know, plays her as a little more, she still has sort of the same sense of humor. And it's an interesting flip that, you know, the character of Dream, who you might expect to be sort of more, you know, sort of flamboyant or whatever, is this really mopey, dour guy. And then Death is the one who has this like sort of bright and upbeat, and, you know, like death is just part of life, yada, yada, yada. So, but yeah, she plays her really well. It's a purely sort of this episode, which combines two issues of the comic. These are both sort of pure character interludes, and that's a sort of refreshing change of pace too. But yes, yeah, so I love this half of the episode. And then we get into the second half, which you mentioned, which is about Dream's friendship with a man named Hob Gadling, who basically decides, he's in a pub in the Middle Ages saying something about how, you know, he never wants to die. And so Death kind of is like looking at her brother and is like, hey, you know, what if I tell this guy, you know, he never has to die unless he decides to. And then so Dream comes back and meets with him every century for like 7 or 8 centuries. I think this also kind of gives the show a chance to make some little time-hopping jokes about aspiring playwright in the pub named William Shakespeare, who's trying to crack his first play. You know, it becomes an episode that's, I mean, just about Dream's loneliness, about, you know, why he's sort of so mopey and difficult to connect with, and that this human being he sees once every century is sort of the closest thing he has to a friend. Laura, what did you think of this interlude.
It's also another storyline that I really liked from the comics, partly because Dream becomes really enraged at Hob, and a bit when Hob suggests that he is lonely and might enjoy Hob's company. And then they don't see each other for a while, but then Dream finally sort of breaks down and realizes that he really misses the guy. And it is like a humanizing note with him. Like, he has all of these sort of tempestuous romances in his past, but that also feels a little on the sort of emo scale, you know, that you would associate with this sort of gothic guy. Like, he has all these tormented, lost loves. But this is just like a guy that he just sits around and has a drink and shoots the shit with, and he finally has to admit that it is really important to him. I like it. I'm a sucker for that sort of thing.
So let's talk about the bonus episode now. There were 10 episodes of this that ended with Dream sort of working things out with Rose and the Dream Vortex. And we thought that was the end of the season. And then lo and behold, a couple weeks later, another episode turns up containing what I think it's fair to say are sort of two of the fan favorite issues of the comic, which is a Dream of a Thousand Cats and Calliope. And having sort of complained that the show doesn't really mix up the styles in an interesting way the way that the comic book does, this one starts off with a 20-minute cartoon about cats. Laura, are you a cat person? Or are you a Dream of a Thousand Cats person? What did you think?
I do like Dream of a Thousand Cats, although it is also a little on the edgelordy side of, like, you know, if the cats could take over, they would just chomp us up and play with us like toys, which I suppose is true, but, you know, you don't really like to think about it. This actually, an interesting thing about this animated sequence is that it uses audio from the audio production. So we're not hearing Tom Sturridge voicing the cat, the Dream cat, the cat that is the equivalent of Dream. It's James McAvoy. And his characterization of Dream is much more sort of passionate and Byronic. And while I like the Sturridge's version, I also appreciate in an animated character in particular that it is more animated. You know, it's a kind of a upsetting story. It's not a cute little cat story. It's about cats plotting rebellion against the human race. I liked it. Yeah. It kind of seems like a trifle, but I liked it.
It seems entirely realistic to me that if cats ruled the world, they would absolutely eat us up in a second and have no gratitude for all our years of, like, you know, playing with feathers on sticks with them. Yes. So I liked it. They get to bring in some great guest cast for this episode, including Sandra Oh, who plays sort of the main Dream cat. I can see why they wouldn't want to end the season with it initially, because it's a sort of a grace note, but it is, you know, a cool thing that I don't think Netflix has done very often before, where they just kind of dropped this thing as a surprise a little bit later, and it made sort of a nice addition to it. The other half of this episode, more like two-thirds, is the story Calliope, which is one about a sort of struggling author who makes a deal, not exactly with the devil, but basically takes over this captive muse from another writer named Erasmus Fry, and sort of imprisons her so that he can have continued inspiration and become a very successful writer. Not surprisingly, this doesn't work out for him in the end. But Laura, as a book person, what did you think of this one?
You know, always depictions of the author's life in films and television are not particularly accurate, but it's just a fantasy of that, and I'm willing to go with it. It's also a little less dark than the comic, because the implication in the comic, or I think it's actually spelled out in the comic, is that in order to get ideas from the muse, he has to rape her. So he has her, like, basically like a sex slave chained up in a room, or imprisoned in a room, and he just goes up and rapes her whenever he needs ideas, which is extremely dark, but also like a weirdly gendered view of what a writer does. So there's an interesting consent thing going on with this, because of course the muse also just inspires people willingly. It's just that in this case, it's not willing, like Dream in the first episode, she's a prisoner. What I like about this is that this series works best as an anthology, where Dream just kind of comes in and participates a little bit to sort of bend the action one way or the other. I really would like to see this series become something like Night Gallery or The Twilight Zone, where the Rod Serling character actually participates in the action. The other thing that I always liked about the comic is when Dream comes to the aid of Calliope, who is his ex-wife, in order to get the writer to release her, he infects him with this kind of overflowing ideas. Like, he just keeps having so many ideas for stories that it's actually tormenting him. And I always thought that that character was a little like Neil Gaiman himself, like that is a little bit of a self-portrait, just because he just has so many sort of ideas of the sort that that character comes up with.
Right, right. Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, there's definitely some self-portraiture in this. There's a bit where Rick Maddock, this author who is routinely raping the muse for inspiration, is at a party for one of his books and is, you know, going off about to this woman about how he considers himself a feminist writer. And it's just this, you know, pretty pointed and a little easy, but nonetheless, like well-taken satire, sort of male feminism. And that's like, you know, that's one of the moments where it feels like, oh, they have actually been paying attention for the last few decades, because I don't think that was quite as prominent in the original issue as it is now. This story, this even more than the diner story, like this one feels a little bit like edgelordy to me. So it's not my favorite note to sort of end the whole season on. Like, I'd rather they went out with, like, you know, cats eating people. But as you say, I mean, I think there's only so much you can do with the character of, like, oh, this immortal god who is learning what it means to be human. That's hard. I mean, it was even hard for the comic to make sort of 75 issues about it. And it's, you know, it is sort of better often when Dream is just the sort of conduit for some human action. That, you know, it's a harder thing to do with a TV series because it's like you want to see the main character. But I do think if they get a second season, which is not yet a certain thing, but it would be nice to see them take the series kind of further in that direction. Laura, thank you so much for spoiling The Sandman with me. I hope we can do this again sometime.
Oh, it's been so much fun. Thanks for inviting me.
So that's our show. Please subscribe to the Slate Spoiler Special podcast feed, and if you like the show, please rate and review it in the Apple Podcast Store or wherever you get your podcasts. If you have suggestions for movies or TV shows we should spoil, or if you have any other feedback you'd like to share, please send it to spoilers@slate.com. Our producer today is Christy Taiwo Macanjula. Alicia Montgomery is the Vice President of Audio at Slate. For Laura Miller, I'm Sam Adams. Thanks for listening.